As scientists continue to learn about the origins of the coronavirus, they're learning about our relationship with the environment.
So factors like deforestation play a key role in the emergence and also the spread of these kinds of diseases.
And tensions are rising on a vessel filled with migrants trying to land in Sicily.
Well, we're currently off the coast of Sicily. We can see land, and we've been waiting on news for disembarkation.
Also, sex workers in Europe are taking new precautions to get back to work.
We got emails from clients from when are you open? And maybe it's a little bit more difficult, but I think we're going to make it. People always want sex.
I'm Carol Hills. Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. Thanks for joining us on this Monday. People in Hong Kong are facing a different reality right now. For decades, the territory has been a semi-autonomous part of China with a distinct legal system and protections for free speech. But Beijing has imposed a new security law on Hong Kong. Critics say it has brought a quick end to many democratic freedoms there. In response, several tech companies, including Facebook, say they will stop turning over information requested by Hong Kong officials. At least temporarily. Here's The World's Lydia Amanalidou.
Here's a hypothetical scenario. Police somewhere in the world are investigating a crime. And to solve the case, they need information from the suspect's social media accounts, let's say their Facebook page. What they can do is go to Facebook and request that data and information. This is actually pretty common. Social media companies process thousands of these requests every year. But now some are saying they're not willing to work with authorities in Hong Kong, at least temporarily. In a statement first reported by The World, Facebook said it's pausing these requests to further assess the national security law Beijing imposed on Hong Kong last week that will apply to requests for data from Instagram and WhatsApp, which Facebook owns. Justin Sherman is a fellow with the Atlantic Council, where he studies internet governance and cybersecurity.
For companies to come out now and say, okay, we're going to reassess what's going on here. We're going to look at whether we should be handing over user data is in some ways a recognition of the fact that the way that private companies operate online in Hong Kong is very likely about to change and quickly.
About to change because of the new and sweeping national security law Beijing imposed on the city. It gives authorities on the mainland broad new powers to police what people can say and do online and offline. If China thinks people in Hong Kong are committing acts of secession, subversion, terrorism, or collusion, they can be punished harshly. Things that people could say freely before are now criminalized.
In Hong Kong, where you previously had a free and open internet, it's likely that a lot of that criminalization of those broad categories of activities is going to mean that people can't speak and organize nearly as freely online as they could previously.
Janice Wong is already starting to see that happening. She's from Hong Kong and lives there now. She's also working on a PhD focused on data protection and privacy at the University of St. Andrews in Scotland.
People have been starting to kind of scrub their social media presence and are starting to self-censor and limit what they say online for fear, because I think of the question mark that the national security law brings.
One of those question marks is how the law could be used retroactively to go after people for things they said days, months, years before the law went into effect.
People are extra cautious as a result of that. So are not only kind of policing or kind of self-censoring what they're doing now, but actually going back in time and changing or deleting and removing some of their old posts.
Some people are also concerned that Beijing will tap into the law and implement the kind of widespread censorship that happens on the mainland under the so-called Great Firewall. Justin Sherman with the Atlantic Council says the new security law could have implications for all sorts of companies operating in Hong Kong.
Part of the benefit of a free and open internet in Hong Kong is that it helps the business environment there.
It's been a selling point for many companies, including, for example, online cloud storage companies.
That you can store your data in a geographically central spot in the Asia Pacific. You can store it in a place that's geographically proximal to the mainland, but is not subject to the same kinds of arbitrary authoritarian data collection and surveillance rules that are in place on the mainland.
The new law, he says, could be a huge bust not just for free speech, but also for business. For The World, I'm Lydia Emanuelidou.
A sneeze, a cough, that's what we've been trying to avoid to prevent the spread of the new coronavirus. But now, more than 200 scientists from nearly three dozen countries have signed onto a letter published today that's gaining a lot of buzz. They want us to think smaller about particles in aerosols. The World's Alana Gordon is following this story. Alana, what does it mean that the coronavirus could be spread through aerosols?
So, Carol, aerosols are particles that are so small you can't see them. They may contain some virus particles. The tricky issue is how that then results in the virus being transmitted in the air. Because, yes, aerosols can stick around longer compared to larger droplets, but they don't have as much virus in them. Larger droplets in the air, by comparison, they come from things like sneezes and coughs, maybe singing. They're bigger, and they may not stick around in the air as long as aerosols, but they carry a lot more virus. So these big droplets have been seen as the primary mode of transmission for this new coronavirus. But now scientists want, as you were saying, attention to aerosols too.
So what's at issue in this letter? I mean, more than 200 scientists have signed it. Why do they want the attention to these aerosols now?
So the issue, Carol, with this letter is twofold. One has to do with the way that the World Health Organization and public health agencies like the CDC communicate risks based on what's known or not and issues guidelines. And then the other issue is on the risk of aerosol transmission itself. This group says there hasn't been proper emphasis on this possibility, and so they want guidelines updated. Joe Allen signed on to this letter. He's an assistant professor of exposure at Harvard School of Public Health. He says scientists like him have been observing evidence of aerosol transmission of this new virus since February.
What WHO and CDC haven't been talking about, and what has been so frustrating for us, is that they haven't been talking about airborne transmission, which means they haven't been talking about the healthy building control strategies that people need to do. Bring in more fresh outdoor air, higher efficiency filters, and still, yes, wear a mask indoors.
So he's talking about better ventilation in places like schools and, of course, avoiding overcrowding. Now, Paul Hunter is a professor at Norwich Medical School at the University of East Anglia in the UK. He's a member of this WHO expert panel that shapes guidelines, and he's in disagreement.
I'm not going to say that aerosol spread of COVID-19 doesn't ever happen, and I'm sure it does. The issue for me very much is whether or not actually it happens sufficiently frequently that we have to put effort into controlling that transmission pathway.
So to him, the balance of evidence is that aerosol spread isn't that important.
How worried should people be about going out in the world and breathing air?
Yeah, so I mean, people like Joe Allen say it's important to really create healthy buildings that have good ventilation to take into account this aerosol transmission. But I asked also his colleague Bill Hannage about this over at Harvard School of Public Health. He's an epidemiologist. And basically to him, nothing is really new here. It's always been known there's been some level of aerosol transmission, but context is important.
Given that we have such an abundant amount of evidence that the greatest risks for transmission are sustained conversation, talking to somebody for a period of time indoors, sustained contact, which could allow transmission between those people, both in terms of droplets and aerosols, given that, we know that, then what this actually means is not a big deal as you might think.
So, Carol, to your question about how worried we should be, you know, based on the modeling that Hannage has studied of this new coronavirus, it's not taking off like wildfire in the air. Do not worry, he says. It's not nearly as infectious as something like measles. So again, it's the masks, the social distancing, hand washing, it all makes a difference.
The World's Alana Gordon, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Borders across the European Union might be closed to many international travelers, but that hasn't stopped migrants from attempting dangerous sea journeys between Libya and Europe. For more than a week, a rescue vessel with 180 migrants on board has been stranded off of Italy's coast. The NGO SOS Méditerranée, which owns the rescue vessel, is reporting mounting tensions on board, with some on board severely distressed. A few migrants are reportedly suicidal. Dominika Wanchik is medical team leader with SOS Mediterranee and is on board the rescue vessel. Dominika, first, what's the current status of the boat? I mean, Italian authorities had given the go-ahead yesterday for the vessel to pull into port, but what's happened now?
Well, we're currently off the coast of Sicily. We can see land. We anchored this morning, and we've been waiting on news for disembarkation, but haven't received any response or information yet. And since this morning, tensions have been rising on deck. Survivors are definitely very distressed and becoming increasingly anxious. It's quite heartbreaking, actually.
There are 180 migrants on board. Where are they from? And are there any children on board?
Yes, 4 young boys and 17 unaccompanied minors. And we have a variety of nationalities, a big group of Bangladeshis, Eritrea, a little bit from all over.
And you mentioned there's a lot of tension on board. People are getting kind of antsy and really want something to happen. How is that expressing itself? What are people saying or doing?
They've been frustrated for many days now. We've been at sea with some of the survivors for 11 days, and this frustration has just been building. And when we received news of a place of disembarkation, they were quite relieved yesterday. And I think this morning, the situation on the deck was quite calm. But progressively through the day, especially with no news and with us unable to provide them with any information, they're just becoming more anxious, frustrated. Yeah.
As far as you know, the Italian authorities have still given the go-ahead, and you're just waiting for them to say, yes, you can come into port. That's the latest?
Yes. As the medical team leader, I submitted a medical report yesterday night. A medical doctor did embark from the Italian authorities to do an assessment a few days ago. The team was here yesterday to do the COVID-19 testing for all of the survivors. I've been sending regular updates on the status, but I have not received a response today.
And you mentioned that the migrants on board have all been tested for the coronavirus. When will you get the results of those tests?
Again, this has not been communicated to us.
If I was on that ship, what would I see? Would I see migrants on board in masks and you in masks and people social distancing? How are you trying to accommodate the pandemic, you know, on a rescue ship? I know it's rough going anyway.
Yeah, we established guidelines before we set sail. All of the crew here did a quarantine of 14 days. And we have all the personal protective equipment against COVID-19. So when we're on deck, all of the crew are masked. All of the survivors are masked. We have a decontamination area before we enter the ship. Yeah.
You know, you've mentioned that some of the migrants on board are very stressed. Are you concerned for them? You mentioned that some are even suicidal.
Yeah, we're very concerned. Over the last few days, they've become increasingly distressed and frustrated and have acted on this. We had 2 people jump in the water. We had to hold people back from jumping in the water. They are extremely distressed to be in this situation, and the situation just keeps being prolonged and I think really pushing everyone to their limits.
Were you able to rescue the 2 who jumped in the water?
Yes, we recovered them right away. We launched one of our fast boats in the water. We threw flotation devices. So we recovered them straight away.
I know you've talked to a lot of the migrants. What are they hoping will happen at this point?
They are just very clearly wanting to disembark, and they're wanting to contact their families that they haven't been able to speak to in over a week now, and they just want to have a place of safety.
Dominika Wanchik is medical team leader with the SOS Mediterranee. She's on board a rescue vessel in the Mediterranean and near Sicily. Thank you so much for speaking with us.
No, thank you.
You're listening to The World. I'm Carol Hills, and you're with The World. Movements demanding social change require sustained energy and commitment. Activists worldwide are looking to amplify today's calls for racial equality and greater police accountability. One way to do that, build international bridges. But as The World's Rupa Shenoy reports, solidarity across nations is tricky.
It was nighttime for some, morning for others. 1,500 people joined a Zoom meeting to connect persecuted people in South Asia with the U.S. fight for Black lives.
If the present moment is a moment in which we only talk about police murder of Black people. We miss out.
Harvard professor Cornel West was one of three speakers at the event, which was organized by Equality Labs, a South Asian advocacy group based in the U.S. West said oppressed people have to stand in solidarity, like Black civil rights leaders did with freedom fighters in India nearly a century ago.
We've got to make these connections so that our solidarity is real and concrete. That's precisely why our conversation today is so very, very, very important.
West listened as another speaker, Tanzila Kambrani, recounted how her people are treated in Pakistan, where as a group they're called Shidis. Traders enslaved Kambrani's ancestors and brought them to Pakistan. She's fourth generation African and the first Shidi to serve in Pakistan's Sindh Assembly. A week before the Zoom summit, Kambrani brought a picture of George Floyd to the assembly floor and introduced a resolution condemning his death. She spoke through an interpreter.
I could see when George Floyd was murdered that the police officer acted as judge, court, and executioner. This is familiar to me because it is the same mentality that oppresses us everywhere.
That statement was echoed by the final speaker, Chandrasekhar Azad. He's a social activist who leads the Beam Army, a group that fights for the rights of lower caste Dalits in India, who face discrimination from higher caste Brahmins. He also spoke through an interpreter.
The abuse of human rights within India is extremely rampant and our situation is very unsafe.
Azad said lower caste women are regularly sexually assaulted and lower caste men face mob lynchings. Dalits have little access to good health care, education or jobs.
Blacklist matter ka mamla chala.
We've been trying to campaign on similar lines over here back home in India. We've learned so much. We've started to have movements like Dalit Lives Matter, Muslim Lives Matter. So we're learning a lot and we're together in this struggle.
But this is where international solidarity gets tricky, especially between people in the U.S. and India. Prime Minister Narendra Modi is described as a Hindu nationalist. Dalits say they're persecuted by his government, which has also passed a law that Muslims say is designed to strip them of citizenship. Yet many Indian Americans believe Modi's been good for India and support him.
Good morning, Houston.
As evidenced last year by the huge Howdy Modi rally in Texas, where the prime minister appeared alongside President Trump.
Good morning, America.
Equality Labs political director Sharman Hussain says the Indian diaspora provided crucial support for Modi's rise in India.
Without the pipeline of support these people receive from upper caste Hindu networks in the diaspora, India's right-wing militias and the Modi government would lack the financial and diplomatic support they need to normalize India's policies of violence towards its caste and religious minorities.
And now Hussain says the same groups that backed Modi are supporting candidates in the U.S., candidates who also say they're part of the movement to protect Black lives. Hussain says they should give the money back.
We must see this money as Hindu nationalist money, and politicians must return blood money.
But one of the candidates Equality Labs has identified as receiving such money is a doctor who says he has a long record of fighting Hindu nationalism and Islamophobia. Pratesh Gandhi is running for Congress to represent a district that stretches between Austin and Houston, Texas, where many Hindu, Muslim, and Black Americans live.
We have to be consistent with our values. If we are going to stand for vulnerable and disenfranchised communities in America, then we have to stand for vulnerable and disenfranchised communities in China, like the Uyghurs, like the Rohingya in Myanmar, and the Muslim community across India.
Gandhi says he didn't know that some of his contributors support Prime Minister Modi. He says he's being held to a higher standard because he's Indian American, and other candidates aren't expected to know where their contributors stand on this issue.
I'm certain that out of the thousands of Indian Americans that are supporting me, there must be those that support Prime Minister Modi, and there are others that must oppose him. For me, as a candidate in America, born and raised in Houston, Texas, my job is to focus on issues that affect the lives of Central Texans.
And those people fighting oppression in Central Texas have allies across the globe. That was the message from Chandrasekhar Azad, the Dalit leader in India, who was on the Zoom call.
This is a fight for humanity. We want to be treated as human beings and not animals. And I want to promise all of you that you are not in this alone. As you fight in this in your respective countries, you will always find supporters over here in India.
Azad and the two other speakers at the Zoom forum, Cornel West and Tanzila Kambrani, pledged to stay in touch, work together, and help each other face the fear of speaking out against oppressive forces in power.
All power to the people!
All power to the people!
All power to the people!
For the world, I'm Rupa Shenoy.
These are tough times for the country of Lebanon. Not only are the Lebanese people struggling to get through the coronavirus pandemic, they're also dealing with an unprecedented economic disaster. And that is exactly why organizers of the Baalbek International Festival decided that the show must go on. The annual performance was held on Sunday in Baalbek's ancient Roman ruins. Musicians played under stone columns of the Temple of Jupiter. But something was missing. For the first time, the performance took place without a live audience. Maestro Harout Fezelian was the conductor. For 1 hour, he said, the performers tried to help people watching the live stream forget all the problems in Lebanon and around the world.
We have to have hope. And without hope, no future.
Without hope, there's no future, he said. The event was billed as an act of cultural resilience. It featured 150 musicians and choral singers with a mix of classical and Middle Eastern pieces. Check out a video of the performance. Find it on our Twitter feed. We're at The World. Some countries are reopening after months of pandemic lockdown, but fears persist of a second wave of COVID-19 infections. Join us tomorrow online for a live conversation with William Hanage, an epidemiologist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Email your questions to myworld@theworld.org and stream the discussion live at 12 Eastern tomorrow from our website, theworld.org. This summer will look very different in many American vacation spots. Foreign workers who keep restaurants, hotels, and shops humming, they're largely missing.
We're going to see how it handles with the busyness that we've got coming. Reservations are through the roof.
A crunch on visas is putting a crunch on vacation towns. That's ahead on The World. I'm Carol Hills. This is The World. We're a co-production of WGBH Boston and PRX. Getting back to work is a top priority during this pandemic. But what if your means of making a living involves physical contact with customers? How safe is your job? It's a dilemma for many, including sex workers. In parts of Europe, brothels are starting to reopen for the first time in months. From London, The World's Orla Berry has the story.
29-year-old Victoria is originally from Ukraine. She lives and works in Eastern Germany, where she's been in the industry nearly a decade.
I started pole dancing and striptease and stuff like that, which is also part of sex work.
She didn't want to give me her full name because her parents still don't know what she does for a living. Victoria tells me she didn't initially plan on becoming a sex worker.
I never thought that I will be able to do more because I thought that the woman or people who do more are stronger and like really tough people. And I thought that it would be really hard for me, which it wasn't.
But it was hard when Germany went into lockdown in March and closed all the sex clubs and brothels. Like most European governments, Germany has paid a percentage of most workers' wages since then. But sex workers were largely excluded. Victoria says she's had to keep working illegally.
To be honest, it's probably like 3 appointments a week just to pay for my food and drinks and everything and not to go too far into debt. I know that it's still illegal, but I still have to keep on living and pay my bills. So the bare minimum.
Most German businesses are now allowed reopen. Not the sex industry, though. In Amsterdam, brothels in the Dutch city's famous red light district can reopen this month. Lotte Alberg owns 2 clubs there. She says some of the women in her clubs continue to work privately through the lockdown. But that put them in a tough situation.
They're not so afraid of the coronavirus. They're more sometimes afraid of the clients, because normally when they work for us, we say like, okay, you have to pay and this is allowed, this is not allowed. And now there are clients who say like, oh, but what you're doing is illegal, or I don't want to pay that much, or things like that.
In Greece, sex workers are eligible for financial aid, but many don't fit the criteria because they don't have legal immigration status, or they work in secret and don't want their families to know what they're doing. Nikki Adams is with the English Collective of Prostitutes. She says the pandemic has left many sex workers struggling to get by financially.
We have seen from the hundreds of women that we've been in touch with that people have nothing to eat. And I spoke to a woman recently and she said, literally, I have no money to pay my rent. Or the children haven't eaten any fresh food for like 4 weeks.
Adams works with the collective that sends food parcels and other emergency assistance to sex workers in Britain. It's the sort of initiative that's happening in other countries too. Lucas Stevenson is with the International Committee on the Rights of Sex Workers in Europe.
What we've seen is that actually the community itself has really stepped up and taken the role of the government in protecting other members of the community so that sex workers don't have to work.
When they do return to work, women will still be at risk of contracting the coronavirus. And some countries are putting out new guidelines for the sex industry.
For example, not kissing with customers, like no exchange of body fluid, etc. Trying to keep distance when it's possible and using wipes, etc. Changing beddings between clients. So there's quite a set of measures to limit the risk.
Nikki Adams is sceptical the guidelines will make much of a difference.
Whether you can take precautions often comes down to how much you need the money. And so leaving women in a situation where they are hungry and homeless and desperate for cash means that we're going to inevitably be more vulnerable to exploitation and abuse and less able to insist on decent working conditions, including implementing any protections against COVID-19.
Going out of business is not a big concern for Lotte Alberg, the sex club owner in Amsterdam. She says she's pretty confident that her businesses will bounce right back.
We get emails from clients from when are you open and when can we come again? And a few days before the lockdown was here, it was very busy because everybody was saying like, oh, it's the last time. We probably go in lockdown in a few days. Maybe it's a little bit more difficult, but I think we're going to make it. People always want sex.
For sex workers like Victoria in Germany, there is the fear that they'll be further stigmatized and accused of spreading the virus. What's required now, she says, is an open and honest conversation about the role that sex workers play in society.
I think the society has to really think the way we think about our sexual needs, because it shouldn't be only a question of morals. It should be also a question of healthcare and compassion. And I really hope that people will recognize their emotional and sexual needs a little bit more.
For now, though, Victoria is just waiting for lockdown to end so she can go back to making a living legally once more. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
There are a lot of competing theories about where exactly the current coronavirus originated. A report from the UN that was released today looks at larger systems, including the relationship between the environment and the formation of new zoonotic diseases. Those are infections that jump from animals to humans, like the coronavirus. The UN Environment Program's Chief for Wildlife, Doreen Robinson, joined me from Nairobi, Kenya. I asked her about the links between environmental degradation and the spread of disease.
Zoonotic diseases are quite complex, and their relationships with the natural world are even more complex. There's so much that we don't yet know. But what we do know is that as the environment is degraded, we know that there is more prevalence of zoonotic diseases, and they are more likely to jump. So factors like deforestation play a key role in the emergence and also the spread of these kinds of diseases.
What happens with deforestation? Why would that increase the prevalence of zoonotic diseases?
Zoonotic diseases not only jump from animals to humans, but they can jump from humans to animals. And as we get in closer proximity, that opportunity for those diseases to jump happens. So in the case of fragmentation of forests, for example, it depends a lot on how a particular disease makes that jump. So oftentimes it doesn't go directly from the species that hosts the disease, but it might go through some intermediary animal. That could be a domesticated animal, or it could be rodents, for example. And so we find as habitats are disturbed, species like rodents that do well in those disturbed habitats, they can jump between wild areas and areas where humans live, they become in closer contact to humans, and thus there's a greater opportunity for that jump to happen.
And what is the current theory about coronavirus in terms of being a zoonotic disease? We always hear about the wet market in Wuhan. And what is the latest on that?
We know it is a zoonotic disease, and the scientific evidence is pretty clear that it probably originated in bats. But what we don't yet know is where it went from the bats and how it got into the human system. Without a doubt, wet markets or traditional food markets, particularly when they don't have good hygiene, can be a source of zoonotic disease transmission. But we don't know for sure yet the role that wet markets are playing with this particular disease.
Now, in your report, you talk about food systems more broadly and how they relate to disease formation. What are the main ways that our food systems make us vulnerable to these diseases?
The desire for meat protein has driven industrialized livestock production, which means livestock are often housed in much closer proximity than they would be in more natural systems. As well, when we are doing this industrialized livestock production, we often tend to breed for a certain kind of genetic production, and that can limit the genetic variability in these animals. When you have a limited genetic variability, once a virus takes hold, it has a much broader opportunity to spread within that population because you don't have that same natural resistance that you would have in a more diverse genetic population.
We often talk about the coronavirus and climate change as separate issues, but your work seems to show that these diseases and climate change are rooted in the same problems. What's the value of seeing the connection between environmental management and diseases like the coronavirus?
It's very hard for healthy humans to live on a sick planet. We've got to start to break down these silos across disciplines. You can't have the health folks working over here and the wildlife folks over here. We've got to start bringing these worlds together and unpacking these complex linkages so that we can find solutions to implement a better way forward.
The UN Environment Program's Chief for Wildlife, Doreen Robinson, speaking to us from Nairobi. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Gay Pride Month in June looked very different this year. Parades across the globe were canceled and events moved online. In China, the nation's only official Pride celebration continued on. But as the world's Rebecca Cantha reports, organizing Pride in China can get pretty complicated.
When you think of Pride, you might imagine a huge parade filled with people waving rainbow flags. So how do you celebrate Pride in a country where parades are mostly reserved for displays of military strength? With a little bit of ingenuity, it turns out. Charlene Liu lives in Shanghai and is one of the founders of China's longest-running Pride festivals. When she and her friends started Shanghai Pride in 2009, it was meant to be a one-time event.
To be honest, back then, none of us thought that we would be organizing Pride for so long, right? It was just for one time, that one year.
They basically threw a big party, and it went so well, they decided to continue. This year, there was a full schedule of events, with parties, but also a film showing, a job fair, a storytelling event, and a forum on inclusion in the workplace and academia. But organizing Pride events here isn't exactly easy. China didn't legalize homosexuality until 1997. It only stopped classifying it as a mental disorder in 2001. So it's legal to be gay here, but it's not a totally accepting environment. In the past few years, there have been media bans on LGBT content, and people have been harassed just for wearing rainbow badges.
Having venues closed down on us is very common, right? Every year we face the same issue, and we always have to come up with a plan B, a plan C, or plan D.
Leo and other Pride organizers always have to be on their toes, and they try to keep festivities low-key. So no Pride parade? Well, instead, how about a Pride fun run and a rainbow bike ride?
We thought that, you know, everybody exercises, you know, we want to be outside, outdoors, and as well as keeping healthy. So we don't necessarily have a lot of events that probably other prides have, but we get by with what we can do here and also what the community is interested in.
Leo has noticed a real change over the past decade. Acceptance of LGBT people and relationships is growing here. Whereas the first pride was led and attended more by foreigners, these days most of the volunteers and participants are Chinese. Like Alex Dai. He's a 55-year-old entrepreneur who's been coming to Pride for years with his boyfriend. It's become a big part of their life. He says, for me, coming to Pride is like finding a home. Many of us can feel isolated, but at Pride, I found a family that accepts me, understands me, and respects me. For participants like Alex, going to Pride is fun and liberating. But behind the scenes, there's a lot of pressure on the organizers, especially during a pandemic.
This year is, we call it a very sensitive year. Everything that everybody does, especially group gatherings, we are heavily monitored. Also, it's because it's for the safety, right? We want to make sure that everybody is safe, that we don't get sick.
Now that Pride 2020 is over, Leo says she and her fellow volunteers can finally take a sigh of relief.
Regardless of the challenges and stress, we know that at the end of the day, someone in the community will be inspired, will be encouraged, will be able to say that they are not alone and that they're able to connect with other people who are probably in the same shoes and also have the courage to be themselves.
And that, says Leo, makes it all worth it. For The World, I'm Rebecca Canther in Shanghai.
Russia is not a forgiving country for journalists. Today, a court on the western edge of Russia found a freelance reporter guilty over a column she wrote a couple of years ago. Svetlana Prokopyeva was charged with, quote, justifying terrorism. Charles Maines in Moscow monitored today's proceedings online. Charles, it sounds like they're all cheering for a guilty sentence. Is that what's going on here?
You know, I think mainly it's a feeling of relief among her supporters, even though Russian court today found Svetlana Prokopyeva guilty of justifying terrorism and issued a fine. It didn't get what prosecutors were asking for, which is 6 years in prison and a 4-year ban from working as a journalist. In that clip, you can hear Prokopyeva saying thank you to her supporters. And you can understand why if you consider that over 99% of Russian criminal cases end up in a conviction. This is about the best outcome you could have hoped for.
What exactly did Prokopyeva write about in 2018 that got her caught up with the court system?
Well, you know, back in November of that year, Prokopyeva read a column over the airwaves of their local radio station about a 17-year-old anarchist who'd blown himself up at the headquarters of Russia's Federal Security Services in a town in the north of Russia. It injured 3 people. It ended the life of this young man, of course. And Prokopyeva really tried to address the reasons that may have led this Russian to do this, as she told me when I spoke to her over the weekend. She's saying that it's important to understand the reasons behind an act of political terrorism so that it doesn't happen again. And in her column, she, you know, posits that Russia's repressive political environment may have played a role in this man committing suicide. And because so there weren't other avenues to express yourself against the government. And this maybe was why he took this more extreme path. And, you know, this seems to have run Prokopyeva afoul of Russia's very opaque anti-extremism and anti-terrorism laws. Which rights groups here say are used to silence critics and independent voices like Svetlana Prokopyeva.
You know, I don't understand Russian, but she sounded pretty cool and collected. Why is that?
Well, she's a pro, in a word. You know, she just hasn't budged under all this pressure from the state. In fact, today she showed up in court wearing a T-shirt that said, "We will not shut up." She's saying that throughout this whole 2-year ordeal of the trial, you know, she's always insisted that she was just doing her job. It's her professional obligation to raise important issues and talk about problems that are important to society.
Now, what's the larger meaning here for journalists in Russia?
It's a complicated picture you get from this case, and I want to bring in another voice here. This is Andrei Zhirblis. He's Russia's representative from the media watchdog group Reporters Without Borders.
Это огромное облегчение, но это не победа
Dribbles says that today's ruling is a relief, but it's definitely no victory. This case was essentially designed to intimidate journalists, and that if nothing else, Prokopyev's ordeal encourages a trend in self-censorship in Russia, journalists basically ignoring issues just to stay on the safe side of the law. And keep in mind that even though Svetlana Prokopyeva was spared jail time today and was given a fine, which her supporters have already started crowdfunding for her, she's still on Russia's terrorism watch list. Her bank accounts have been frozen. She can't travel. You know, it'll be some time before her life gets back to normal. She's made clear she'll appeal this decision today. But she also says she has every intention to keep on reporting, which I certainly hope she does.
Reporter Charles Maines in Moscow. Thanks as always, Charles.
Thank you.
Wear a mask. Keep your social distance. Wash your hands. Those messages lit up the night sky in Seoul, South Korea this weekend. About 300 small drones moved with amazing precision, creating shapes high above the Han River. A heart, a couple wearing masks, and the Korean flag were displayed in colorful lights. The drones also spelled out words of gratitude for frontline workers. Thank you, and cheer up, South Korea, were drawn above. The high-precision, futuristic light show lasted 10 minutes, but the South Korean government did not advertise it in advance, you know, to prevent a large gathering. You can see some of those incredible images at theworld.org. Iran's nuclear program looks to have been set back by a few months after a mysterious fire broke out at one of its main nuclear facilities in central Iran. The damage was significant, according to Iranian officials. Some of those officials also say the fire was caused by a cyber attack. Suspicions have been cast on both Israel and the United States. David Albright is the president of the Institute for Science and International Security, a nonprofit group in Washington that tracks nuclear proliferation. David, so what exactly was damaged by the fire, and how significant is it to Iran's nuclear program?
The building that had the kind of an explosion and fire, which appears to have been quite damaging, was a facility Iran had built over many years to assemble what are called advanced centrifuges. And what's significant about the facility is that it was designed to be able to mass assemble these centrifuges.
And remind us what the significance of centrifuges are.
Centrifuges are used to enrich uranium. And so they've been at the center of the whole controversy with Iran, because one day a centrifuge can be producing low-enriched uranium for a nuclear power program or civil nuclear program. The next day, it can be converted quite easily to making weapon-grade uranium for a nuclear weapons program. And the international community spent a lot of time to try to limit the use of the centrifuges through international inspections, through, you know, this nuclear deal. But in the bottom line is, for many in the world, there's just a mistrust that even with these arrangements, even with these inspections, at some point Iran will use them to make nuclear weapons.
Officials in Iran are saying they have evidence proving that this was sabotage, but they're not yet making it public. Could this mean that we could expect some sort of Iranian retaliation before we learn the details?
Iran could decide to retaliate, and I think it's been trying to avoid having to face that by the international media or states that are kind of pushing the case into Iran's face. Now, when you started this program, you said it could be set back a couple of months. It could be much longer than that. I mean, one of the failings of the nuclear deal has been that there hasn't been a full understanding of what Iran can do in terms of making and assembling centrifuges. There was no accounting of that under the nuclear deal. But there is a sense that this was a site that was very important, where they were concentrating their capabilities. And it could be that they don't have a lot else, anywhere else, that can do it on a mass scale.
So what value does the 2015 nuclear deal have today?
Well, the main value it has today is that I think the states involved have to start renegotiating it. I mean, there has to be a new balance found. I mean, there's, in a sense, too much water has gone under the bridge to just go back and say, let's pick this up again. And Iran doesn't appear willing to enter any kind of negotiation like that with the Trump administration, but perhaps with the Biden administration would.
David Albright is the president of the Institute for Science and International Security. Thanks a lot, David.
Thank you.
We're now in full summer vacation swing, and it's safe to say this summer will be like no other. On Nantucket Island, off the coast of Massachusetts, tourists are arriving. But one group of people is still missing, foreign seasonal workers who help serve the people on holiday. Here's the world's Rachel Rock.
Jakob Gregorik is at home in Zagreb, the capital of Croatia.
There's a mountain called Medvednica. It's a national park, so it's really nice.
Gregorik, who's 24, is a college student studying transportation. Most of his friends are working the summer jobs they lined up months ago, but Gregorik is still looking. He was supposed to be working at a bike shop on Nantucket Island in Massachusetts. Then the pandemic hit. Visa processing came to a halt, and last month, the Trump administration further suspended many guest worker visas, like the one Gregorik got last year.
We had no news for months and months. We were kind of prepared for it, that something's going to happen. I mean, we're still sad because we want to go. It's a great experience.
Normally about 1,000 J-1 temporary visas are issued every year to international college students. Many work at tourist spots ranging from Disneyland to Nantucket. Last year, Gregorik hustled in Nantucket. He worked at the bike shop, but had time left over.
So I found myself a second and a third job.
He brought $8,000 back home. This summer, he says he doesn't expect to make more than $2,000 in Croatia. He says he'll miss the cash and also the chance to practice his English and gain work experience in the U.S. 4,000 miles away on Nantucket, Gregorik's former boss at the bike shop, Joe Conway, says he misses the young Croatian. But so far, he's managing.
The way the business is slow, it works out pretty well. That it's working out so far.
Conway has 15 employees this summer, down from his usual 30 to 35, normally including many foreigners on J-1 visas. He's concerned the business will pick up and he'll be shorthanded.
We're going to see how it handles with the busyness that we've got coming. Reservations are through the roof.
For years, Nantucket's economy has relied on the J-1 student labor for the high season. Decades ago, before the visas ramped up, U.S. college students did a lot of the summer work. But at least in Nantucket, the tourist season has expanded, running into October. U.S. students must typically go back to school in August. Foreign students, though, can often stay into the fall. But there's another reason that Conway prefers J-1 employees.
Very hard workers. They do pay attention. They listen to you. It's been amazing, the work they do. And I've had a lot of students come back, and they just want to work.
So instead of people on visas, who has Conway hired? High schoolers and a few college kids. He doesn't agree that the Trump administration's decision to suspend many of the temporary work visas helps people in the U.S. who have lost their jobs. Conway said this is what he hears from people about the seasonal work he offers.
Well, no, I'm not going to work for $15 an hour when I'm sitting at home collecting $25 an hour.
Through unemployment payments. Businesses all over the island are feeling the labor supply squeeze. Christy Farantella is the head of Nantucket's Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, I think a lot of businesses are going to really struggle this year. Talking with a restaurant owner this past week, she typically employs 90 people in the summer, and this year she's going to be doing it with 26.
This scenario is now happening nationwide, says David Beer, an immigration policy analyst at the Cato Institute, a libertarian think tank.
Tens of thousands of businesses across the United States who need workers, and this order is going to disrupt that, ultimately delaying the recovery and causing more economic hardship.
How disruptive might this all be? On Nantucket Island, at least, it depends on how business goes during this highly unusual summer and fall. For The World, I'm Rachel Rock, Nantucket, Massachusetts.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carol Hills. I'll be back with you tomorrow.